are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, August 8th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. On today's program, Branko Maricich of the Jacobin magazine on why the right hates Ilhan Omar so much. It's more than all the obvious reasons. It's also in addition to all of the obvious bigotry and xenophobia, she gets it. And she's got serious programmatic answers to America's crises, making her a great leader and a big threat. ICE agents raid work sites in Mississippi, arrest 680 people in the largest single state immigration enforcement action in U.S. history. The children of these dying documented immigrants have been relying on strangers for food and shelter because, of course, it is so urgent that we terrorize people at a food processing plant in Mississippi.
I feel safer already.
I know. Doesn't everybody? You can just ease up a little bit. Speculation that a long-standing pattern of reprisals from companies for complaints about labor violations. India revokes Kashmir's special status. They've shut off the phones and other forms of public communication. Troops deploying. Pakistan suspends train service to India as that situation intensifies from the fascistic Modi government. El Paso terrorist mother called police. She was concerned about her son's gun ownership, but there was nothing they could do. Everything was absolutely legal. Iran still pushing for the restoration of some type of peace or deal. The White House is drafting an executive order to tackle Silicon Valley's alleged anti-conservative bias. Wanda Vasquez will be Puerto Rico's third governor in a week after a high court ruling. UN IPCC report says that climate change threatens the world's food supply. That'll help stabilize things as J.R. Bolsonaro fires the head of a climate agency, a science agency, because they were satellites were documenting the rapid deforestation of the Amazon. Sergio Moro tries to move political prisoner Lula da Silva to a general population prison. And in Honduras, massive demonstrations against that U.S.-backed narco state. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Folks, I really want, I mean, it is so important to get really basic and really basic humanity stuff, team human, non-human, when it comes to these immigration cases. There's any number of policy debates about immigration. Obviously, I am on the very much left of immigration, by which I mean everybody that lives here now and has lived here should be immediately granted status, citizenship, period. Crossing the border should not be a criminal offense. Should be, if anything, a minor civil one. Should be totally decriminalized. The United States, as well as, by the way, the Europeans, should follow all international law that they have signed up to on refugees. And more broadly, we need to address the security state and climate policies that are driving so much accelerated migration across the world. There's still going to be borders. And in fact, many countries, as of now, and in fact, many countries on the receiving end of, as an example, U.S. foreign policy, are quite interested in how to have a open fluid relationship with the rest of the world in terms of travel, trade, commerce, and exchange. But they actually would like their sovereignty to be respected by U.S. foreign policy, as an example. So I say this because these debates can get very abstract and very, very quickly in ways that really have nothing to do with the debates that are taking place and the urgent response to what is happening from this administration and from ICE right now. This is, again, if you think that this is acceptable, if you support that raid that is putting children in shelters or relying on children, on strangers for food and clothing or whatever else, that really is, I mean, this is a deeper version. I don't mean like this shouldn't be partisan. It is clearly partisan. And in fact, maybe it should have been more partisan because Democratic leaders helped set the stage for this through their own policy sets. But this is human or not. If you support this, you are not a fully paid up member of the human race. And I wanted to highlight, and again, that is not every single policy issue that you could have about immigration. That one is, to be really clear. And this one also is. This story, I mean, I'm sorry. I actually have some hesitation about sometimes sharing stories that are just absolutely, you know, depressing, frankly. I actually think there's some job that we have here to engender a little bit of a sense of hope and possibility, even as we cover all this stuff. This story is just horrific, just awful. It's just a documentation of the human cruelty of the Trump administration and ICE. An Iraqi man who was born in Greece came to the United States as a child and was apparently never properly documented. 6 months old. I don't know.
Sneaky.
Yeah, very sneaky. Grew up here, worked, never caused any problems. Nothing. He was deported to Iraq. The man is an American. He doesn't speak Arabic. I don't think he'd ever even been to Iraq before, let alone live there. Well, this man died because he wasn't able to access insulin for his diabetes. This is just pure, pure, raw, uncut human cruelty. And again, anybody who would defend this is not human. I want to make, because again, I keep wanting to make that distinction. You might hear some people say, well, I got a different idea about borders than you, or I have some different thoughts about X, Y, and Z. And again, I am of the school that the left in general needs to be able to argue effectively, hear different viewpoints, and so on. Not because of persuasion, but frankly because of how the project is branded. But this stuff is outside of the bounds of human. Again, these policies, whatever ICE person did this has a death on their hands. The Trump administration has a death on their hands.
The chain of command here, and anybody who touched this should be exposed personally and, you know, facing trials for the rest of their life.
Just obscene. Here is a video of this man who died.
Michelle, what are you doing here?
Jimmy El Dawood, I was deported 2.5 weeks ago.
Speak up, please.
I was, I've been in the United States since 6 months old, you know, and just 2.5 weeks ago, immigration agent pulled me over, said I'm going to Iraq, and I refused. I said I've never been there. I've been in this country my whole life, you know, since pretty much birth. I missed birth by 6 months, and they refused to listen to me. There was an agent, Kamaj. The Department of Homeland Security is located on 333 Mont Elliott, Detroit, Michigan, 48207. Agent Kamaj, I'm not sure about the other one, if his name is Deitch or what his name is, but they just wouldn't listen to me. They wouldn't let me call my family, nothing. They just said, you're going to Iran, and your best bet is to cooperate with us. That way, we're not going to send you off, and we'll put you on our commercial flight. I begged them. I said, please, I've never seen that country. I've never been there. However, they forced me. I'm here now. And I don't understand the language, anything. I've been sleeping in the street. I'm diabetic. I take insulin shots. I've been throwing up, sleeping in the street, trying to find something to eat. You know, I got nothing over here, as you can see. I was kicked in the back a couple days ago, claiming to get off the guy's property. I was sleeping on the ground. He claimed it's his property. You know, I begged him. I said, please, sir, I've never seen this country. I don't understand language. You know, nobody speaks English.
I don't. I'm sorry. I apologize. I don't really know how to move from that. It's evil. It's evil. I shouldn't swear. Sorry. It's evil. If you are defending that, you're not a human being. You need to save yourself. You need to access your humanity. And the people who did that, that really is some Nazi, I'm following orders stuff right there. The level of sociopathy and cruelty and grotesqueness of the policy set, and then the fact that, you know, those guys are probably just hitting a quota, getting a thrill, getting a kick out of the fact that, you know, whatever distracts them from their miserable lives, they can just go and just destroy somebody's life.
Go home to a cigar and Hannity.
Cigar and Hannity. It's absolutely disgusting. And it's outside. It's not human. I'll keep repeating it. There needs to be... And again, that is the stuff. That's one of the reasons also that I really do recommend that you specify that those rhetorical pushes can't be used on every single thing because they are here for certain things. That is Nazi stuff. That is totalitarian. That is murderous. That should be criminal. Every single word you could throw at it. And if there is an ability to prosecute the people who did this, absolutely. I mean, there needs to be. We talk about broader needs for like historical understandings of this country across the board and truth and reconciliation commissions. There's going to need to be a truth and reconciliation commission out of this.
Yes.
I mean, this is just terrorism. Directed from the state. And some of it will absolutely be implicated under, you know, the Obama administration too. There's no doubt about it.
The entire history of the Department of Homeland Security.
Which is a short history. Yeah. This is created in after September 11th. There is no broader institutional memory here. This is a, from the outset, national security state boondoggle that was created to securitize and surveil the Muslim population infinitely above and beyond the bounds of the small and surgical measures you need to take to protect from actual terrorism. And it's been weaponized now to terrorize immigrants across the board and undocumented people. And if you think that your life is safer because you support a policy that murdered this guy, then honestly, the most compassionate thing I could say for you is that you should immediately seek help. And I don't mean that as a polemic. I mean, literally, you should seek help. If you experience actual physical anxiety because this man was in your country, you need help. You need urgent help. Not being polemical, not being sarcastic. I mean, as Joe Biden would say, literally, you need help.
I will also say this. If you're maxing out donations to Donald Trump, you need to be exposed by Joaquin Castro.
100%. And if you're the CEO of SoulCycle and Equinox, and I don't normally go for these things, but I'll tell you what, guys, cancel those memberships.
It hurt Uber.
And this guy comes out and he basically tries, you know, I'm summarizing, but essentially it's like, no, we're doing a Hamptons fundraiser for Trump because I'm a greedy SOB, not because I'm a bigot. I mean, and of course, frankly, being a greedy SOB leads to the same results as what we saw with this man in this indirect ways. Whereas if you are starving the state to give yourself more handouts and money, that's killing people. Yep. So it's the same thing, but I don't know. That just really, maybe we shouldn't start it that way because it's very hard for me to move from that. I'm sorry. But that is one that must be told. It's like those stories.
Share that story, guys.
There's clips when you see a police officer murder, you know, it's like some of these things, you know, people need to see them. They need to be real about this. This is what gets abstracted. And, oh, it's about there's a border and what we need is a common sense approach. I mean, when, you know, this is what is missing here, again, in a very specific conversation about these ICE policies and this approach, which really, frankly, I mean, just again, to put it in real terms, George W. Bush's immigration proposal, which was totally business friendly, had all sorts of onerous demands on people to document citizenship and was not a justice-oriented bill. And he did do a lot of very militant moves at the border. This would not happen under that immigration deal. Wouldn't happen. So you need to be very specific about the set of policies that you're supporting here. Okay. You know what? Sometimes transitions are just transitions. And
they're overrated.
And I'm going to read some ads now. That is part of the paradox of our existence. If you believe that you're being snooped on and that nobody cares about your... let me restart this. If you believe that you're not being snooped on or that nobody cares about your online data, you're wrong. Your privacy is under attack by hackers, governments, ad companies, and ISPs. You need a trusted software that will protect your online activity. ExpressVPN. Their app uses powerful encryption data to their apps use powerful encryption to secure your data. ExpressVPN runs in the background of your computer or phone, and then you use the internet just like you normally would. Simply download the app, click to connect, and voila, you're protected. ExpressVPN is the fastest VPN. It costs less than $7 a month and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. ExpressVPN uses new cutting-edge technology called Trusted Server to make sure that there are no logs of what you do online. It's time to stop hackers, Big Brother, and internet companies from grabbing all your data. Take back your online privacy with ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn.com/majority for 3 months free with a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/majority to learn more. If you feel like you can't find time to read all the books on your list, you're not alone. Blinkist is the app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed into 15 minutes that you can read or listen to with the app. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, tablet, or web browser. You'll find everything from health and self-help titles to history and business books included in Blinkist's library. I absolutely have been using Blinkist to plow through business and efficiency books and marketing books. Stuff you obviously have to be aware of as you build out these kind of businesses, frankly. And I love it because, you know, a lot of those books, definitely they have a lot of filler in them and they're really supposed to just be informational. So I get the information I need without, frankly, like the redundant case studies that some of those books have. And in the free time that I have saved, I can watch a creationist cat video, which I like now. They really are really quite funny. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, all for one low price. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist.com/majority. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break. We will be right back with Branko Maricich.
America, 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 you are so grand. I wish I was deep in America tonight. America. America. I watched David Letterman in Australia. Oh, America, you are so grand and golden. I wish I was on the next flight to America. Captain Christofferson, Buck Sergeant Newberry, Leatherneck Jones, Sergeant Cash. What an army, what an air force, what a Marines, America.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Bronco Marchatich. He is a contributing writer at the Jacobin magazine. Bronco, thanks so much for doing this. By the way, how did I do?
You did well. That was perfect. Maybe the best of anyone who's ever introduced me.
That is unbelievable.
And now I'm just buttering you up. But I think
I know, and I'm going to take it. I'm not going to hear any of your irony. I think everybody.
I don't want any tough questioning, you know. So I have to sort of lead with the high praise.
I'll be Trumpian. I was like, everybody heard what he said. It was the best introduction. Everybody loved it. Everybody agreed. And by the way, he's a great guy. Bronco, besides, I mean, what made you, you have this great piece, Why the Right Hates Ilhan Omar, and, you know, stipulate that there's the obvious reasons. She's Muslim. She wears a scarf. She's African. She's a woman, right? And of course, not all people on the right, but obviously a lot of people on the right have bigotries and fixations about these things. But what's the bigger reason, or maybe not the bigger reason, the other reason, the under-examined reason of why they find her to be such a threat?
Yeah, well, Omar kind of alluded to this in that New York Times op-ed she wrote shortly after the send them back controversy, where she basically talked about how racism through American history has been used to divide people who otherwise have a lot of stuff in common, share class interests, but it's been used to divide them and to make them feel like they can't partner with people just because they have, they happen to be of a different race or gender or whatever, what have you. Omar's career has really shown, and I think, this is something that she self-consciously kind of really tries to embody, that you can bring people together under a common political project. Who, maybe have different backgrounds, who maybe are different in certain, aspects of their identities, but ultimately share a lot of things in common. And Omar, throughout her career, has kind of built these coalitions of voters and supporters with a combination of, kind of universalist programs like canceling student debt or the National Bill of Rights for Renters, for example. So things that really cut across all these different sort of aspects, race, gender, that kind of thing. But also, specific social justice oriented stuff. So, trying to make Minnesota a sanctuary state, for instance, or, trying to prevent local police from getting their hands on, insane military equipment, that kind of thing. So Omar really, obviously, as you said, she's going to piss off a lot of racist people just by the fact of who she is. But she's also a direct threat to the way that the right tries to use racism to divide working class people so they can basically just keep working for the 1%, for lack of a better term.
Well, I quote her, quote you quoting her. throughout our history, racist language has been used to turn Americans against American against American in order to benefit the wealthy elite, she wrote. Back to her. If working Americans are too busy fighting with one another, we'll never address the very real and very deep problems our country faces. And so that's, I mean, that's exactly right. And it's also interesting because, you know, again, in terms of like sanctuary cities, in terms of serious substantive work on civil rights issues, which I think is a very, to me, I like that framework. Her record will go up against anybody's, right? I mean, as an example, she voted against the ICE funding bill. I mean, that's a very basic vote on whether you are, you know, battling these terrorist immigration policies, right? And at the same time, though, she's not, you know, migrating into like the most toxic version of like the neoliberal pseudo woke discourse, where you are, you know, you're getting like, you know, another version of like, well, okay, we'll cancel student debt, but it's only going to be for certain people. And there's all these different benchmarks that have to be met. And we're actually creating like more division and bifurcation, not as toxic or as dangerous, obviously, but nonetheless, still not just having a broadened out base where every single human being needs healthcare, as an example.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this isn't in the in the piece, but Omar has really kind of subtly tried to kind of fight against those really reductive approaches to, I guess, looking at politics. In her, when she won a seat in the Minnesota House, she was actually in a three-way race between one person was a 44-year incumbent. She was a woman. I believe one of the first women to get into the Minnesota legislature, but don't quote me on that. But, you know, I think she was kind of a pioneer for her time. And she was also facing up against a Somali-American man. And people at the time kind of noted that she had this historic appeal, I guess, that she kind of was she was sort of several firsts rolled into one, right? Because she was a refugee, she was a Muslim, she was a woman. And Omar said, you know, yeah, you know, sure, I am going up against a Somali American man, but I'm also going up against a woman, and I'm a woman. You know, we have to look beyond just our identities and take the conversation beyond that. And as another example, after she was elected, she faced some racist abuse from a taxi driver that was taking her somewhere. I can't remember where now. She actually refused to press charges, and she basically said, you know, we're not going to be able to criminalize hate. We can't get rid of hate by criminalizing it. We have to take other approaches. So I think she very much, I think, based on those kinds of statements, really understands that point that you're making.
What is her district like that she represents in the House of Representatives?
Right. So there's this idea that because she's a Somali American refugee, a former refugee, her appeal must be, you know, rooted in sort of purely kind of like, I guess, ethnic chauvinism, I guess, for lack of a better term. I actually got some racist hate mail after writing this. You know, somebody said basically, oh, you know, the only reason she's there is because that Somali community voted her in. Right. If you actually look at the district, it's not true at all. The district is, I believe, 2/3 white. I mean, it's right. The most diverse district in Minnesota.
But it's Minnesota.
But it's still mostly white. Exactly. Right. Yeah, it's, you know, yeah, as some people say, you know, it's like being the sluttiest nun. So, I mean, the idea that she's only there because she appeals to sort of, one narrow constituency is just completely wrong.
And so she actually got compared to Ken Martin, the Democratic Farm Labor Chairman, said that she reminded him of Paul Wellstone's 1990 campaign for the Senate. And that was, I mean, like the Paul Wellstone, I don't know as much about him as I should. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily get talked about as much. And you know, if he was a senator today in the kind of ascendant environment, I mean, he'd certainly be on the left. He might not necessarily be as, it would have been actually really interesting to see where he would have gone. I think, you know, always to his credit, right before he died in a plane crash in 2002, he did vote against the invasion of Iraq when he was facing re-election, which, as in demented as it sounds, was considered to be a pretty politically brave thing to do at the time. But he ran for Senate in 1990 as a college professor, community organizer who had supported and worked in Jesse Jackson's campaigns, had no big donor base, and again, in 1990, was running as like a Midwestern left populist. So there's a lot of credit where credit's due in that race. And could you just maybe talk a little bit more about that very interesting comparison? Because it is a real Minnesota thing to draw the Paul Wellstone, Ilhan Omar connection.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is that both Wellstone and Omar, and you know, countless examples that we can pick throughout history, really kind of gives the lie to this idea that's advanced by people like Amy Klobuchar and a bunch of other commentators, which I'm sure we've all heard these arguments that kind of left-wing ideas don't play well in the Midwest. That, you know, you it's more about incremental small reforms, about moderation. Clearly that is not the case. I mean, Wellstone, as you point out, was considered this stalwart liberal, you know, a liberal lion throughout the time that he was in Congress, until he died. Obviously Omar herself, who is significantly to the left of someone like Amy Klobuchar, she's managed to get multiple victories in the state. And, you know, you have a history of socialists winning power in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota, often at the local level, but I think sometimes even higher offices. So, yeah, I mean, I think part of the comparison to Wellstone as well is with the nature of her campaign. She, from all reports, really just dove into the campaign. She knocked on just countless doors. She was, somebody called her, you know, relentless, because she just never stopped campaigning. She was just always talking to people. And there was one political operative who had predicted that, you know, the max turnout that they could have gotten was something like 5,500 people for that state race. And in the end, they actually ended up turning out a slightly larger number than that. So I think it was something like 5,868 or something along those lines. So, you know, very much a similar approach to what Bernie Sanders is doing on the national level, trying to not just appeal to voters who are going to get out on the day anyway and you know, cast their vote, but actually appealing to people who otherwise might not bother and who have checked out of the political process, particularly at the local level. Part of her outreach was actually appealing to the local university population as well. So that's, I think, sort of where the Wellstone comparison comes from.
In terms of an actual proper, you know, real solidarity, right? Like, we've already documented that Ilhan Omar has a very sophisticated understanding of how the use of race and racism has been used, you know, to divide and subjugate the working class and then the racial hierarchies within that. She's totally unafraid on issues of immigration, rights across the board. And then she had this really ambitious, great policy set, canceling student debt, Medicare for all of the things that we need to do in the sort of broader social democratic sense. But one thing that's left out of a fair amount of conversations, and I actually think, you know, it's very much to Bernie's credit. I think Bernie's actually been doing some really significant things on foreign policy. I think it's credit. I mean, again, he's the only candidate for calling to free Lula as an example. That's a major issue. But she has been absolutely unafraid to oppose regime change attempts in Venezuela. She had that incredible exchange where she revealed that just, you know, grotesque Elliot Abrams. Talk about how the foreign policy dimension fits in.
Yeah, I mean, is it any wonder when you think back to some of that stuff why this woman pisses the right off so much? I mean, that grilling of Elliot Abrams, I mean, I think most people, you know, hadn't seen something like that in US politics for a very long time of, well, yeah, I mean, I you know, I can't remember something similar happening, you know, in recent years. I mean, she didn't just unquestioningly kind of challenge him on his record of war crimes and really kind of point out what an awful man he is, but at the same time challenge these long established kind of precepts of foreign policy in the U.S. And also kind of broke this silence, this, you know, the idea of civility that, you know, you're not meant to tell a guy who's a war criminal that he's a war criminal. That's uncouth. But, you know, beyond that, and you know, also I would say at the state level, when she was in the state house, she had sponsored a provision that was going to ban military aid to Honduras, for example, which obviously has been mired in sort of all manner of chaos after the 2009 Obama-backed coup there.
Right.
But the other part of it is as well is that, you know, the whole idea behind the hate towards her and the kind of smears that are launched against her is that yeah, okay, first the claim is that she's an anti-Semite, but also it's this idea that she's kind of this alien force, this, you know, that's kind of basically a foreign terrorist. She's kind of working at the behest of some shadowy international movement of Muslims. And the hilarious thing about that is that, I mean, like, basically, it's the Trump administration that is really the one that's beholden to a foreign power. When Omar got elected, Omar and Rashida Tlaib and others, Al Arabiya, the Saudi-owned state newspaper, published a piece basically calling Omar and Tlaib, you know, Muslim infiltrators, which is, I mean, you know, this is coming from a Muslim country, a Muslim theocracy, in fact, or a very repressive one. But they were accusing her of, you know, being this sort of infiltrator. And of course, as we know over the past few years, forget Russiagate. I mean, Trump has been far more deferential and servile to Saudi Arabia in power, to the point where, I mean, you know, you've got Saudi officials spending tons, you know, just throwing money at his hotel. Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, was basically fired from what reports say because of his opposition to Saudi Arabia's conflict with Qatar. And I mean, you know, you could go example after example. And of course, this isn't unique to Trump. I mean, presidents, successive presidents, including Obama, Bush, they were all very, Bush notoriously so, they were all very deferential to Saudi Arabia. I mean, deferential is, that word is not even accurate to really describe how nicely and favorably they treated that country.
Right. And I think, yeah, I mean, whatever one thinks of the Russia stuff one way or another, it always struck me, though, as just so comedic that like stipulate that there was some type of grand conspiracy, you know, in the real like Jonathan Chait fever dream variety. And so like, and the Russians started setting this up in the 80s and they did all these deals and all this stuff. And then the Saudis are just like, you guys are idiots. Like you just fly him out. You put his face on a billboard, you give him a sword and you say he's awesome. And then like maybe you backdoor some hotel deals. Like why do you make it so complicated?
Give him a cool looking orb.
Right.
And put his hands on to pretend like he's Saruman or something.
It's not that hard. It just you say he's great and then there's an orb. You guys are morons. Like why do you complicate the simple?
Yeah, clearly Russia has a lot to learn when it comes to foreign influence from Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, and Saudi Arabia's influence is out in the open. They're spending just millions of dollars a year on lobbying. You know, they have literally lobbyists work for the newspapers of record that, you know, including the Washington Post that you know, whose tagline was changed to Democracy Dies in Darkness. I mean, they had
columnists. Or the Turkish embassy. Lobbyists. Sorry. Bad joke. Apologies.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
No. I mean, yeah, it's absurd.
Do you find actually pivoting off of this for a minute, I mean, do you think that that's a really powerful reframe of being able to speak honestly about the Israeli occupation as an example? That every time they tried this move on Talib or Omar, they're more willing than almost anybody else in Congress to speak honestly about the Gulf states too.
I mean, how effective it would be as a form of messaging, I can't say, but I think it's an important thing to point out that, I mean, you know, the attacks against Omar, and maybe if I look back on this, I'd be incorrect, but from memory, the attacks against Omar, the really concerted focus on her began when she did that grilling of Elliot Abrams. So, I mean, I think it is clear that the way that these new congresswomen are challenging power and you know, some of the most basic core elements of thinking in Washington and sort of these assumptions that everyone for decades has taken as granted as you know, as being definitively right. I think that is a big part of it. I mean, you know, you did not really hear the same sort of criticism, particularly of Israel. I mean, that's really new. This sort of very harsh, unflinching criticism of Israel's policies towards the Palestinians. It was really kind of invisible from the from Congress before these congresswomen came in. So I think that is a big part. I think it's always worth pointing out to people the ulterior motives that sit at the heart of attacks on left-wing political figures, whether they're in Congress or whether they're just activists.
So you've made the point, looping back to the beginning, I mean, that obviously white supremacists fear and hate her because she just in her existence is a threat to their horrific, you know, their grotesque vision of society. And in that respect, it's not terribly different than why they hated Barack Obama so much, even though Barack Obama was, you know, a center-right Democrat, totally different politics than Ilhan Omar. But you say the right more generally recognizes that she's a more potent threat to all of the orders that they hold dear, including most especially the economic ones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the right hated Obama because he was a black man. But what did he actually do? He bailed out the banks. He didn't prosecute anyone on Wall Street. He ramped up the drone program way beyond what Bush had done, you know, really expanded the war on terror, killed a lot of Muslims, in some cases, American citizens without any due process or anything. I mean, this is just a short list. Obviously, we could spend days going through the failures and terrible things that the Obama administration did. But yeah, ultimately, the hatred of Obama by the right was partly completely irrational and partly a strategy that by never giving in and never giving him really any sort of kudos or victory, it was a way to drag him and push him further right, which worked. With Omar, however, you know, it's not just the fact that they hate her because of who she is. Unlike Obama, she really is someone who is using her position to challenge power, particularly the sort of some of the warped kind of worldview that exists in Washington, D.C. So she's a much bigger threat. I mean, you know, in many ways, she's, you know, kind of all the terrible, ugly stereotypes and conspiracies they had about Obama, that they feared that, you know, he was going to, you know, change America's foreign policy and that kind of thing. That's a lot more accurate about Omar. Obviously not the really racist stuff, but, you know, just the stuff about fundamentally reshaping how Washington works. Obama was never going to do that, but Omar really is. So, I mean, I can only imagine the kind of how people are being driven crazy right now, how these right wingers are being driven crazy.
Right. And at the same time, still a actual powerful advocate for a pluralistic democracy, while this, you know, ultra xenophobic anti-Muslim administration is also hand in glove with the most repressive theocracy on the planet, and in fact has materially funded the ideology You know, that gets specifically centered on groups that commit actual terrorism, which are obviously a very small amount of Muslims. So, like, the just kind of disgusting ironies abound here. And so, you know, I mean, I think we all support her. We're all incredibly struck by her bravery and her vision. And do you think, like, the last thing I'd like you to touch on, too, is that it strikes me that for all of, like, her great politics, her identity, all of these things, that the other part of what makes her so effective is actually that, like, you know, like a Bernie Sanders or any number of other really good political leaders, she's very plain spoken and actually keeps it really simple and direct.
That is a key to political communication. I think that the stuff like the West Wing, not only the West Wing, but that was a big part of why liberal technocrats kind of took this very high-minded style and have an aversion to populism. Whereas someone like Omar, you're right, and Sanders, they put ideas that people haven't necessarily been exposed to before, they put them in terms that those people can really understand. And that's not saying that you know, people are dumb or anything. It's just, you know, if you're not familiar with ideas, I mean, we saw that with the Joe Rogan interview right. with Sanders recently, right. where right. All these people, you know, you look in the comments and you look in the posts and on subreddits about the video, and these people say, you know, I've only sort of gotten these sound bites of Sanders. Now I hear him actually talking, and I realize he's actually not that radical, and that he has a lot of good ideas. And I think that is important. I you know, for a lot of people, you know, sorry to talk about Sanders again, but a lot of people kind of objected to or thought his speech on democratic socialism, where he basically said it was the unfinished business of the New Deal. People had a variety of criticisms about that. Some people said that on the one hand, he shouldn't be leaning into democratic socialism. That's a bad idea. After the speech, other people said, well, it's ridiculous to say that socialism is just sort of taking the New Deal a little bit further. It's not, although, you know, the same people saying that wouldn't even want to do anything nearly as ambitious as a New Deal. So that's always important to remember.
Right.
But the key there is that Sanders, by invoking FDR and the New Deal and couching his view of the world, his vision for the country in that history, he is using terms of reference that ordinary Americans understand. You know, I mean, people probably don't know that much about FDR and New Deal, but that, and you know, not that that was a especially radical thing that FDR did. I mean, ultimately, you know, he did this to save capitalism. However, nonetheless, it was still a program, a wide-ranging program that transformed many people's lives, that put the government front and center in people's lives in a way that hadn't really been done ever before, and really shifted people's thinking. And you know, more to the point, perhaps pissed off a lot of rich and powerful people who, even though Roosevelt wanted to maintain capitalism and save it, I mean, you know, these guys were ready to do a coup. They were planning to get him out of office. So I think, I think Omar and Sanders, I think both of their successes in electoral politics are, I think, a good role model for people, you know, in the future, whether politicians or activists. And, you know, how do you bring people over to your side, you know, and as you say, using direct language that is rooted in the experience of the constituents you're trying to win over, I think, is a key.
Indeed. Bronco March Etich, best pronunciation ever.
Top five for sure.
Well, oof. All right. That gets a little trickier when we're talking about the world of podcasts, getting into the top five. That could be, that was very sneaky, Bronco. That could be really either very good or very bad. The piece is...
Well, the interview's over. I downgraded you after this one.
Now you can mess around. See, that's now you're doing Trump. I make deals. It's like, you know what? I'm smart. I praise up front. I condemn after because I'm smart. Why the Right Hates Ilhan Omar. Great essay in the Jackman. You can read all of Bronco's really smart essays in the Jackman. Bronco, thanks so much for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks. All right, folks. We got to get to the fun half. I will say, yeah, we're not going to go very long on this fun half. On my next Thursday, I always have to reset. Next Thursday, we'll go to what I guess is our new normal time. But man, when I started on this show, we could end at about 1:45. 2 o'clock was normal to slightly pushing it. And if it went to 2:10 or 2:15, it was like, that was a long show.
That's about when I started too.
That was even when you started, right?
Yeah.
I mean, 1:45 was already done when you started.
Yeah, no, I don't remember.
I think 1:45. I mean, that wasn't. 2 o'clock
was like, we're about
2 o'clock.
Done.
2 o'clock. Like 2:10, we're about done. Now it's like, I mean, now what's crazy is I feel like we're inching towards 3, basically.
Yeah.
Right? And I maintain.
We're right past 2.
Yeah, we apathetically steamrolled past 2. So we're going to actually end at about 2 today. But I think we have to hold the line at 2:30.
I mean, this studio pumps out a lot of stuff for people to enjoy a week, so.
Indeed. And let me just add to other things you can enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Blinkist. Blinkist is the app that takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them in just under 15 minutes for you to read and listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off of your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. Matt, what's going on, Literary Hangover?
Literary Hangover. People should check out my first episode on James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, because that is a very interesting novel where it's James Fenimore Cooper sort of mythologizing his father's landlord ways of how, you know, this country's founded by basically financial interests. It's not pioneers. Like, the money, like, we're going to need to commodify something before we let people settle these lands. That's basically how American settlement has worked. And Cooper, like, he omits certain things, like there's not yearly elections, which were a big part of his dad's life and big aggravation for him. So he depoliticizes it in that way. But a lot of the sort of economic elements of it are extremely interesting. There's overfishing of rivers. There's when white settlers first came to America, there were huge flocks of just millions of birds. And the new settlers used to just, like, shoot cannons and stuff into it. And just birds would just flop on the ground just because, like, there's a bunch of them.
Just
it's fun.
Like, I've actually read similar accounts of Chinese soldiers doing really similar things in Tibet.
Yeah.
Tibet's ecology and wildlife.
It's a giant flock of birds. It's like a big dragon. You just
Settler colonialism.
People were going off back then with exploiting the land and like chopping down trees, because you burn a maple tree, you get a bunch of potassium, and that was good fertilizer because there's a lot of droughts in Europe. Anyway, all this is in this book, so it's really good. For patrons on Saturday, and there's also going to be a part 2 for that. For patrons on Saturday, this weekend, I think it's going to be on Saturday, we're doing George Orwell's A Hanging, which is actually by Eric Arthur Blair. It was before he had changed his name.
Eric Arthur Blair.
It's one of his, it's a very eloquent anti-colonial writing. It's about his time as an imperial policeman in Burma. And it talks about putting people to death. So it's also one of the most eloquent anti-capital punishment essays that I can think of anyway.
Fascinating. On Tuesday's TMBS, that was another great episode. We really...
Wolf in studio.
I mean, look, I've always been happy with the show we've done. But I've always been... I mean, look, it's a good show. But it's really, the show is really, just check it out. We're really hitting our marks. Is China a socialist economy? An illicit history of Afghanistan and Pakistan? Plenty of other topics, including a really good, always a really good post game. I won't explain all of them. I'll just say that patrons get 2-to-1 content. This weekend, we're doing a primer on Hong Kong with Elaine Yu of French Free Press. She's a reporter based in Hong Kong. And if you want to get a broader flavor of the show, we have a highly populated Michael Brooks Show YouTube page now. And We're about 63,900 subscribers. So keep us growing as subscribers on Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel and become a patron to get the whole thing. Patreon.com/TMBS. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back in the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.